This is the Midweek Drive Morning Edition on Siren 107.3 FM.
Excellent. And as promised, we have the 1989 New York Independent Film Festival Award winner, Professor Jane Chapman, with us. Jane, how are you?
Hello. That's the billing that I'd forgotten all about.
It's all there. Of course, these days, you're Professor of Communications at the University of Lincoln, yes. Also a comparative media historian extraordinaire, specialising in comics and cartoon archives for the World War in particular. Drum roll, obviously, and a whole range of other factors. But we'll find out about that as the show proceeds, including the latest fantastic exhibition that you've obviously recently been responsible for and curated. And I noticed you're also looking for exhibitions in 2015 as well that you're putting together in Australia.
Oh, yes, a second world
exactly.
one and an Australian
it's
one.
It's phenomenal. Yes. Almost as phenomenal, it has to be said, as Liv Clark, and probably equal in many ways. Liv, you're doing all sorts of marvellous things. Good morning, how are you?
Good morning. I'm not too bad. I've had a good sugar and a coffee, so do a little bit more and we'll get there in the end.
That's all right. We'll work your way through that. As we pointed out to Jane prior to the show, Liv was one of our students in the media communications course, but then went on to do great things in journalism and a whole heap of other things. And now, after an interesting sort of diversion in her life path, she's actually going to take part this Sunday for the Cancer Research Race for Life 5-kilometre event, which is wonderful. So, Liv, share with us. Why have you decided to do this, which seems completely insane, but still, you're going for it, and more power to you.
Yeah, no, Alex, thank you for that. I've supported Cancer Research UK, the Race for Life events, which are run by Tesco's here in the UK, pretty much since they started down in Battersea, and I just believe that there's so much sort of cancer stories you hear out there, everyone touched it in one way or another, or experienced it, that we just have to all work together and try and raise as much money as we can to get a cure, that one day in the future we just won't talk about cancer. Hmm. So the reason I'm doing the race this year is I wasn't actually going to cancel it because I've not been very well myself mm-hmm. this year. But I've been told I can walk it rather than run it. So
that's
5K,
good.
What, 3 miles? I think this is the lap around Lancaster University a couple of times and then collect some nice fundraising sponsorships from my friends and family.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. Jane, I mean, it's always nice when we see our sort of graduates doing these kind of things, isn't it? I mean,
it just shares
that positivity that's around. Even though a little bit of history here, obviously, as a comparative media historian, Liv Clark was one of the original founders of the precursor to Siren and indeed the early days of Siren, Universal FM, back up in Hull.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know.
Yes. Yeah. What year was that, Liv?
Oh, many years ago.
it was the last century, Jane. You know, obviously.
Right.
It was
94, 95.
There we are. 94, 95 from that perspective. It's astonishing. So let's just briefly, how do people actually support you, Liv? What's the easiest way? Because obviously you're on Just Giving. Is that the easiest way to actually go through to if people are listening to this, either live or via podcast? Should they actually turn around and say, let's go for Just Giving?
Yeah, it is absolutely, Alex. It's the most secure and safe way to donate, either in the UK or whether you're overseas as well. And it's verified because there are a lot of sort of cloned accounts out there. You've got to be very careful when you donate money online. But justgiving.com is safe, secure, and you can donate as much or as little as you like. If you're in the UK, our government, bless them, give you an extra 25% on top of the donation as a gift aid release for any funds that are given. So it's a really, really good way of monitoring that. And also I can see and thank people who have donated. So literally it's justgiving.com, which is just giving all one word. It's /LivXClark 2014.
And we'll make sure that's promoted and done in all sorts of wonderful ways. I'm sure it'll be a huge success. Jane, any questions for Liv about life, the universe, or indeed the run, or any advice, really? Because, I mean, you might well have been secretly, as well as obviously being an ace comparative media historian and all the other sort of wonderful things actually there, fellow of Wolfson College, Cambridge, of course, you might have also sort of been doing marathons as well. So
I have to confess I haven't, and I'm not even sure I could make it. I have handed out bottles at the London Marathon to the runners.
Well, there we are, you see.
Yeah, bottles of water,
that's actually more important than taking part because volunteering in the charity sphere is very, very sort of a big struggle for charities to get people just to donate time. So, Jane, that's really admirable that you've been able to take that time and pass the bottles out.
Well, it's a great way of watching the London Marathon, actually. Good luck, Viv. I think I don't have any advice. I admire you for what you're doing. It's great.
It's fantastic stuff from that point of view. Weather check. Do you know the excitement has been such? We haven't even given the today's weather. It's 24 degrees centigrade for a high, a low of 16 degrees centigrade, if you can call it a low. It's a fine and settled day with light winds and some sunny spells, which I've ordered for you. for the actual walk slash marathon on Sunday, of course, Liv. So
don't go there with the weather, Alex. The northwest is immune from this heat wave. We haven't had it. We're not going to come. We've got flood warnings for the weekend, so.
Well, that'll be good. Liv, I know what you'll do. You'll simply convert it from a sort of walkathon into a swimathon. So it's quite simple. Exactly. This is the critical thing from that point of view. Liv, we support you in every sense of the word. So great to see that you're coming together with respect to that. And obviously, once again, a reminder, it's Liv Clark, Just Giving for Cancer Research UK. You can go there, you can go to the Facebook side of things. And obviously, it's the Race for Life 5 kilometre event. Still to come on the programme today, we'll be talking about the dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Richard Fitzwilliams will be talking about that, plus more. We'll be speaking to Chris Newton, who will be making his debut on the production. Chris is an interesting, I'd almost say, celebrity solicitor. A solicitor group which is almost taking over Yorkshire. In fact, I'm holding a Newton's pen in my hand. We encountered Chris's wife, actually, at a photographic stand at the Great Yorkshire Show last week with Javin Liam. That's sort of quite fascinating from that point of view. And we'll be talking to William Sitwell about his views on a whole range of food stuff as he actually heads off to the excitement that is Lourdes. We've also got an interesting line on Andy Jones, who is a relationship expert and journalist, which is quite extraordinary, Jane, in many ways.
Very useful relationship expert.
Exactly. Yes, journalists do have relationships. It's astounding. Yes. You know, it's really quite weird. But you know, there we are. He'll be talking about that. And also why people tend to be attracted to cars. I mean, Liv, I should say. It's very confusing. Any particular car that you would sort of say, yeah, that's the car for me?
Oh, I've just done it this year, Alex. I finally got a BMW.
Really?
And I can actually vouch for all BMW drivers. The indicators do work on the steering column. I've been confusing people all week by actually, you know, telling people where I'm going. So the BMWs do have working indicators.
Yeah. I have to say, I am not impressed by cars. I think they're like computers, a terribly bad investment because they just go down in value. So you're throwing money away. Right. So I have got an old Mercedes that's like a tank that is 19 years old, and it's held together with sticky tape. Literally.
I mean, that's a whole new series, Jane, I think, right there. You know, I could see that, you know, that 1989 New York Award is going to be replaced once we actually get together, you know, on the road with Professor Jane Chapman and her Mercedes. I think it's going to work. Liv, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
I have, as always, Alex. Thank you.
And I take it you'll be back in the very near future telling us how the whole thing went and sharing with us all sorts of things. Interesting, you've actually gone for a Wonder Woman mix. I'll mention that to Arthur Weingarten, who wrote for the series last time it was actually on air. He's joining us on the show next Wednesday. So
it's my guilty pleasure, Alex. Wonder Woman is my guilty pleasure.
Well, Wonder Woman is one of the people, the characters that we're writing about in my project.
Exactly.
Well, because people don't understand the whole Nazi connection and the historic reasons why it was on air, why it was suddenly taken off air. So. Mm.
And, of course, Charles Moulton, I believe, the founder and creator, who also, as well as creating Wonder Woman, also came up with the lie detector test.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. It's just one of the whole systems there. But was that bikini really useful for fighting crime and Nazis, Jane? I don't know.
No, but it was quite a positive image.
Exactly. Well, these days, Thor has become female. So, you know, Thor is changing gender, you know, from the god of thunder to the goddess of thunder. Extraordinary. Looking at the whole sequence here, we're thinking, is it Dawn of the Planet of the Apes? Is it Rise of the Planet of the Apes? It's obviously a prequel to Planet of the Apes, which we probably understand. Isn't that right, Richard Fitzwilliams?
Well, yes. In fact, it is Dawn, but you're quite right. It might have been other. The name, however, is one thing. The quality is another. And I'm happy to say that at a time when, you know, you can get rather swamped by sci-fi blockbusters, there are two that I think are excellent, and that is a certain Games that are still being played out in front of President Snow, starring Jennifer Lawrence. And
you're still going for Hunger Games, then?
I am.
Not Transformers.
You could be right. You could be very, very right. And also the fact that the Planet of the Apes, and hopefully when it finally arrives, Star Wars 7, will be that which we will want to see, because I mean, Planet of the Apes series, firstly, the masks the apes themselves, these creations.
Created by the Frenchman, of course, Pierre Boulle, who did Monkey Planet. Without Pierre Boulle writing Monkey Planet, no Planet of the Apes.
So you're perfectly right, and in fact, going back to the 1960s, when we had that absolutely amazing Planet of the Apes with Charlton Heston, I was always rather shocked that when Heston died, the climactic clip, let's leave it at that, was played on a large number of radio stations, including, to my memory, Radio 4.
Outrageous.
It was, but it was brilliant, and there's no doubt that it spawned, so to speak, prequels.
Prequels, sequels, and a variety of other things. Of course, the original teleplay or screenplay was written by Rod Serling, known for The Twilight Zone. Let's bring in Professor Jane Chapman, who is our comparative media historian and Professor of Communications here at the University of Lincoln, as well as a whole wealth of other routines. I mean, Australia, India, internationally renowned, which is always wonderful. A Planet of the Apes person, Jane? I mean,
well, I enjoyed the Charlton Heston original. Why not?
Yes. Of course, you know,
the only thing that worries me about the history of Hollywood, you know, is they are playing safer and safer.
Really?
All
do you
the
think
time.
So?
Yes. But you know, certain formulas work, like, you know, Planet of the Apes, mm-hmm. and so therefore you have to have prequels or sequels or whatever.
But we are almost celebrating
Terminator 7, whatever.
It's
a bit tedious.
Our colleagues in Los Angeles, Phil Leonis and Dean Hagland, were actually doing a little location report at the Hollywood Cinema, the Hollywood Heritage Museum. We now are just into the 101st year of Paramount Pictures. And the first movie that Cecil B. DeMille directed in 1913-1914, because he wanted the tax break, obviously, over 2 years, even then, thinking about the business side of things, was indeed The Squaw Man. And that was a successful novel. You know, movies have always done that. And
yes,
then
no, that's one thing. Making a movie of a successful novel is one thing. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about
talking
is milking
about
the formula with,
yes,
you know, constant...
Terrible.
Yeah, extra ones. Thank you, Richard.
I could say something that words might help to block the fact that Spider-Man 1, 2, 3 and then went into Amazing Spider, etc., etc. This type of playing safe, I suppose. Bernard Shaw once memorably commented that the cinema is also an industry, and this is what is foremost in the minds, I fear, of so many in Hollywood, that the fact that you have to go through endless sequels. Occasionally, of course, there's The Godfather, then Godfather 2, and so on, but that was an exception. There's no question that that is so unlikely to recur. What I do grasp onto here with Planet of the Apes is that this movie, the series, and there's definitely going to be more, it does have a very, very distinctive visual style. There is this amazing recreation of these creatures, if creatures is the word. In fact, the award ceremonies haven't actually got a place where they could, an award section where they could actually honor Andy Serkis for these amazing portrayals. Remember, he did Gollum and he did Dobby.
And King Kong. Let's not forget King Kong.
Oh, King Kong was, that too was extraordinary. It was actually, I have to mentioned Peter Jackson being very, very indulgent, but after the here's a series that I loved, the obviously Lord of the Rings. I mean, that was amazing, truly amazing. So I don't grudge him the fact that it was grossly self-indulgent and an hour too long. But even so, it's a problem with all these, with the blockbuster series, that the moment there's a success, there's got to be numbers 2, number 3, sometimes number 4, 5, etc.
Am I hearing, Richard, that you might be somewhat critical of James Cameron already booking in Avatars 2, 3, 4 and 5?
Well, I would simply be resigned to the fact that I'd expect him to do it. Mm. But I do take the point that, you know, you've got this playing safe in this way. You must therefore make sure that when, say, for example, you get Iron Man 3, some of that was very good and very entertaining, and I rather enjoy the franchise, Robert Downey Jr. super, but climactically you've got to have, for example, battles and action sequences that really are much tighter, say, than this one was, and that the Amazing Spider-Man ones have tended to be, because you have very, very silly characters. I mean, Kick-Ass 2, for example, the battle at the end of that, the action sequence there was absolutely terrible.
Mm. I can sense you're not a fan. Never mind. A growing nation of genetically evolved apes led by Caesar is threatened by a band of human survivors of the devastating virus unleashed a decade earlier. They reach a fragile peace, but it proves short-lived as both sides are brought to the brink of a war that will determine who will emerge.
I think that is an extremely good summary because it doesn't give away any spoilers.
Why would I do that, Richard?
Well, nobody ought to do it. You'd be amazed how so often it actually happens. But there's no doubt you've got the simian flu and the way we see that that spreads and so many humans are dying. In fact, it's rather dramatic because you're unaware as to whether or not any human colonies have survived outside the one that is able somehow to resist the spread of the flu in San Francisco. And outside the city, such as is left of it, not much is, you have a colony of peaceful apes. But there you have Caesar, superbly played by Andy Serkis, or created, should I say, by Andy Serkis, but you've also got Koba, who is a monstrous creature. Humans have scarred him irrevocably, and he's out to cause as much trouble as he possibly can. When he discovers that there's a colony of humans that's nearby, he's out to, firstly, dethrone Caesar, and secondly, he's out for war. And you've got all the ingredients for some very spectacular action sequences. I especially must recommend the apes in a hunting sequence where they hunt stag by swinging from tree to tree with other apes waiting with nets. It's most spectacular. Also, there's a magnificent use of flaming torches and fire in the action scenes, which have a...
Sounds like an average day in the life of the academics at the University of Lincoln, actually, Richard.
Sounds like something to give you nightmares.
That also sounds like an average day in the life of the University of Lincoln academics, you know, still. Richard, stay with us for a few moments, because I'd like to, in a sense, reverse the interview procedure as well, have you, and provide you with the opportunity to speak to Professor Jane Chapman about her work as a comparative media historian and some of the fascinating exhibitions she's putting together, because I do sense you might like to join us on one of our London location reports where we actually will check out one of these wonderful exhibitions, which is actually still running and extant.
Yes, excellent. At the Cartoon Museum.
Brilliant.
In London, which is just near the British Museum, and it's on cartoons and the First World War.
So, Richard, are you happy to stay with us and come back after this short musical break?
Yes, very definitely.
Which we could have also used for Liv Clark's upcoming Race for Life. Although, sure, there won't be a whole issue there in any way, shape or form. OK, Professor Jane Chapman in the studio, Richard Fitzwilliams online. Jane, would you like to share with us this fantastic work that's been, I won't say 100 years of the making, although arguably there is a point for saying that actually if Archduke Ferdinand hadn't actually had an unfortunate incident 100 or so years ago, we would probably not be sort of talking about the incident now as we commemorate or look to commemorate the First World War. Two angles. Not only are you curating and coordinating musicians, you're also the BBC's number one correspondent, or at least expert, in terms of the whole World War One commemoration package.
Well, yes. I mean, I have to be a little bit more specific. Number one expert.
Well, we like to use a bit of hyperbole on the show,
it's,
Jane.
It's for a series that the BBC are doing that many of the listeners may have listened to or watched called World War One at Home. And it consists of 1,400 stories throughout the country, local stories about the First World War commemoration, finding things that have been lost, you know, forgotten history, etc. And each region has been given a target within that 1,400 it's actually 20 per radio station. And I represent the East of England, where there are six radio stations, so we've had 120. But next year, I'm going to be the national coordinator, because there are actually other folk like me that need herding and leading.
Yeah, number one to be, exactly. This is critical for that point.
So we do websites, we do radio and we do TV, and we have to approve the scripts that the BBC journalists come up with and the ideas, give them ideas as well, check for accuracy and make sure they get it right.
Always important, Richard, as I'm sure you'll confirm.
Indeed, and in front of me I'm looking at this amazing exhibition. You've with Never Again, World War One, cartoon yes. and comic art, that as well.
Yes, I have to say I didn't do all of it. I mean, the curator.
Oh, come now, Jane.
Well, I mean, you're given credit here. I can read it.
Exactly. It's on the web, but you can't disbelieve something that's on the web.
Extensively researched by Professor Jane Chapman from the University of Lincoln.
Oh, are you reading something? I didn't know that existed. You have to send me the link.
Who's also contributed to the exhibition. Yes, indeed. Yes, it's the Cartoon Museum website.
Oh, right, yes.
So what
yes.
do you think,
Richard? I'm doing a talk there as well, by the way. It's further ahead. It's the 1st of October. But they have a series of talks for the public to go with the exhibition as well.
And, of course, the exhibition with the Kitchener cartoon or poster.
Yes.
I would want to say that the difference between a cartoon and a poster, I suppose Your Country Needs You was, in a sense, a cartoon, wasn't it, of a sort?
Well, no, not really. It was an illustration. I don't think there's any aspect of caricature in that poster, and it was actually never used. But
it's used frequently these days, of course.
Oh yes,
all over the place.
Absolutely,
oh, yeah. Everything.
Absolutely. And I've heard one art historian say it's actually the eyes of Kitchener that attract you, because he was actually slightly squint-eyed. But no, there's a difference between posters that will be illustrative, that could be real, and cartoons that are kind of Mickey-taking, if you like.
Yes, the one of the Kaiser that I'm looking at, certainly not flattering.
No, that's right. Yes, I mean, exaggerating the ugly points or making them out to be somebody else or look like something else, you know.
Does the exhibition at all, it doesn't, I don't see any examples in front of me, but there was this feeling, the way anti-German hysteria was whipped up by images, which appeared to me to be cartoon-like images of German atrocities.
Oh, you're talking of Rijmakers. Yes, that's a really interesting story. Rijmakers was Dutch, and Holland was neutral in the war, but the Germans tried to put pressure on the government to arrest him as a cartoonist because they thought he was contravening neutrality. And what he had done is to come up with 150 cartoon depictions of atrocities by the Germans on the civilian population in Belgium, and he'd been asked to do this by the Allies in order to give credibility to this particular piece of propaganda, which I think was true. And he went to court. The Germans put a price on his head of 12,000 guilders, dead or alive. He went to court, and then he fled to England and France, and he took those particular drawings on tour all over Europe, and they've been reproduced as cigarette cards, and that's what you see in the exhibition, they've also been reproduced as big posters, A3 and that kind of thing as well. They're kind of classic because the Germans are depicted as Satan, as skeletons drinking blood, I mean, all sorts of nice science fiction things.
They are monsters, absolutely. I've seen copies of them. I mean, they are absolutely monstrous, but to
yes.
what extent was this true? I've seen the figure of 6,000 civilian deaths, but was this largely propaganda, or were there were some instances, apparently, of German atrocities?
Yes, I think there were. I mean, don't forget, the Germans actually marched 2 million troops into Europe. And so Alex's point earlier, Franz Ferdinand had not been bumped off by Gabrielo Princip, then the First World War may not have happened. I'm not sure that's true. I think it may have happened anyway, and the Germans were already...
The railway timetables is extraordinary.
Yes, yes.
One remembers, oddly enough, the history master in the film If, played by Graham Crowden, who bicycles into his classroom and talks about Europe in the 19th century and the growth of nationalism, and then I quote, culminating in 1914 when the German Kaiser is told by his generals that he cannot win the war he has started because it would spoil the railway timetables on which victory depended.
Yes, I think A.J.P. Taylor first put that one in, didn't he? I mean, they were locked into a whole series series of manoeuvres, and they did actually mobilise really quickly and send troops in very fast.
The idea that once one mobilised, they couldn't demobilise. It's yes. quite horrific to read today, because yeah. the Russians, the Germans, and so forth. I mean, and the French, and of course, subsequently, the controversy that's been raging in some of the newspapers over whether Britain should or should not have become involved in it. I mean, I saw a program, one of the commemorative series that they had some weeks ago on the BBC, and the person who opposed the idea of Britain becoming involved actually produced a selection of experts, most of whom didn't back his point.
Well, that
up.
Was Niall Ferguson. I was there, actually. That was the BBC Two debate. I was there yes, in the audience, and he called me, and they called me to speak at the end, and I kind of laid into him because I thought that his... some of the things he said were quite outrageous.
Why did he actually produce or have experts who didn't agree with
him? Well, nobody agreed with him.
Yeah, that's what I couldn't understand.
Well, I think they had felt, the producers of the programme had felt obliged to wheel in all the best historians and specialists, but none of them agreed with him. But we weren't told about the film that he'd prepared, and it was all highly organised. He'd done all this film beforehand, and it was all centering very much around him. And all these tremendous experts with a lifetime's work, you know, really didn't get much of a look in. I thought it was a very bad programme. I was very dissatisfied. But what really upset me the most was when he was saying, well, if the Germans had one, it wouldn't be any worse than, you know, the EU at the moment with the Germans dominating. And I thought, what? You know, the EU is a democracy. Kaiser's Germany
was
autocratic.
Well, I think David Cameron might beg to differ, but that's a different line of time.
Well, at least we get a vote for the European Parliament, even if you don't use it, you know. But it's in no way is Angela Merkel or, you know, comparable to the Kaiser. I mean, you know, they were autocratic, militaristic.
Doesn't that tie in with the notion of history ultimately being a system of beliefs replacing another system of beliefs at times, though, Jane?
The systems of beliefs differ, and you have to be able to see the difference between them, I think.
And also, I've been hearing an occasional Radio 4 piece on the First World War, and this extraordinary trip the Kaiser took on his yacht. I mean, just as matters were reaching climactic.
He probably had the equivalent of crisis. What crisis? You know, maybe it could have been the James Callaghan of his time, really. But
yes, it's quite extraordinary. The functionaries, Bethmann Hollweg, as I remember, was it not?
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes.
And these messages that were sent, and how the chief of the German staff interpreted things and so on. Just individuals who seemed totally incapable, as we look back on them, of any idea that they might perhaps stop this, considering Germany presumably had it in its power to do it if it hadn't given the so-called blank check to us.
I mean, one of the problems with the Kaiser was that he took it on himself to lead the military manoeuvres, which was a mistake.
And not from the front either.
No.
That's been pointed out. You know. I think warfare obviously took a big step backward when the leaders realised that if they didn't lead from the front, there was more chance of them surviving. Just a minor point there, but still.
Well, of course, I mean, the kings used to lead.
Exactly.
Dettingen was the last example in 1743, wasn't it, where... George II led the army into battle. But there was an extraordinary story in this Radio 4 piece about the Kaiser. I can't remember precisely who he visited, but he kept saying, this time I'm not backing down, saying it so many times that it appeared to be some sort of complex, that the person was extremely, a slightly bizarre character as we read about him and his personality, and that you know there was the fact that his personal status was behind it, and so on. It does sound so chilling when we hear and hear the sort of thing today, knowing what actually happened.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the fact is that he was the figurehead, if you like, but with tremendous power, behind a whole machine that was hugely complex. And there was all sorts of diplomatic deals that had been done behind the scenes and, you know, other alliances and partners and money.
Tout ça change, c'est la même chose.
Yes, money and loans and, you know, if we win, then you can have this piece of territory and then we'll take that piece of territory. And the Allies were equally locked into this. So it was really way too complex to kind of to get out of.
Don't get me started on the Treaty of Versailles as well. But anyway, that's another line for another time.
Lawrence of Arabia might come in.
I think that would be happening, Richard.
Oh, yes, interesting character.
From Dawn of the Planet of the Apes through to Professor Jane Chapman's work on the comparative media history and indeed the First World War. Richard, do you think we should actually sort of set up an audio postcard to visit Professor Chapman's exhibition in London?
I think that would be absolutely fascinating, yes.
As we were unable to actually make the official opening, which is still huge sort of apologies for, Jane, but would you can we schedule something in the next few months?
Well, definitely. It's on until October.
Exactly.
I would love to. Yes. I think it's something that would be absolutely fascinating.
And in fact, you could come and cover my talk, couldn't you?
Well, there we are, you see. And the location, once again, is?
It's the Cartoon Museum, which is just near the British Museum in London.
Yes.
Cartoon. I know it well, yes.
Cartoon, not Gordon of Khartoum. Easily confused.
Cartoons like
exactly.
I really appreciated that, Alex. I had almost confused them.
Well, there we are, exactly. Richard, I take it you've had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the show today.
Absolutely fascinating.
And we'll be back again next week.
Yes, indeed.
All right, okay.
Bye from Ireland.
Very good to see you down in New Orleans, man. Yeah, here he is.